This is Teachers Talk Radio, and you are listening live.
Hello, and welcome to The Late Show with James Radburn. This is Friday, the 3rd of May. Now, tonight I'm going to be joined by my guests, Alex Bedford, Laura Meadows, and Elliot Morgan, as we talk around the topic of task design, designing tasks at challenge. So sit back, relax, and grab a drink for what is going to be a fascinating conversation.
This is Teachers Talk Radio, and you are listening live. Tune in live at ttradio.org, or to join in the conversation, download the Podbean app and search Teachers Talk Radio. Follow the hashtag TTRadio. Tune in, talk it out with Teachers Talk Radio.
Hello and good evening all. This is going to be a fascinating conversation tonight. We've got some great guests with us, Alex Bedford, Laura Meadows and Elliot Morgan as well. Welcome all. How are you this evening?
Very good, thank you. Very good. Lovely to be on this with all these wonderful people.
Brilliant. How are you, Elliot?
Very well, thanks. How are you doing?
Yeah, it's not too bad. It's a little bit grey and dingy. I wonder where the sun is going to be for this bank holiday weekend. And how are you, Lauren?
Hi, James. Really well, thank you. Just rejoicing in a bit of Friday evening cup of tea. How about you?
Yes, definitely. I've got a cup of tea in one hand and I've got a beer in the other hand. So hopefully that'll be a good mix.
This is my kind of show already.
Oh, exactly. Exactly. So let's go into a little bit about, I often start with the question is, what is your purpose? Because I always think that gives an idea around you as an educator and also your path. And in particular, this idea that we want to look at task design tonight, but also tasks that challenge that we'll look at probably in the second half of the show. And I know we've all been on this pedagogical journey and I know we've had conversations before. So, Alex, if you start it off and then we'll go through each of you. So what's your purpose and what is your thing about education at the moment you're really passionate about?
That's a really good question to begin with. And for me, it's that every child, regardless of their starting points, has the right to think hard. And that's a mantra which we take through, and it's something which we champion, because everybody has that right to think hard, and we want to bring equity and equality into the curriculum. And the more work we do around task design will bring that equity and equality for all to think hard.
Really, really nice way of putting it. Lauren, how about you? What's your purpose?
I think that's a great question. I'm sort of trying hard to put it into something succinct, James, but anybody who knows me knows my absolute commitment is servitude to children. This is about achieving great outcomes, giving children the best possible chance to thrive. And as Alex rightly says, we can't do that. We don't ask children to think hard. I'm sort of perpetually excited about the state of education in that, you know, I believe we know more every day about what works in the classroom. And my kind of great sadness about education is how little of that knowledge consistently makes its way into the daily diet for the children that we serve. So I suppose my purpose is about distilling the evidence that we have about how we can get children to think hard directly into practice in a way that's meaningful, that's tangible, and that serves both children and those working with children.
And don't worry about being concise, because I think one of the beautiful things about the group of us almost is we get those insights into lots of classrooms within the work that we do. Absolutely. As well as our own. And I think that insight is really, really important. And Elliot, so you don't worry about being concise. There's nothing about being concise tonight, so no pressure. You go around in circles, it's fine. So what would you say is your purpose? Because I know you've written a lot, you've talked a lot around this idea of task design and challenge at the moment, but what has led you into that path that you're thinking in that space at the moment?
It's very difficult to not be concise there, because Alex and Lauren basically summed up everything that they share the same purpose as me, and they put it much far more eloquently and articulated it much better than I ever could. But so I share their sentiment. Ultimately, I see education as like an odds game. Everything we're trying to do, we're trying to increase those odds that all children learn. And I think task design is a very important piece of that puzzle, but often a very overlooked part of that. I mean, the last few years, curriculum and instruction have sort of dominated our discourse as a profession, and for the betterment of teaching across our nation. But I think task design has been something that's been ignored during that process. In terms of how I got into it, I was just always creating my own tasks as a teacher, and then I started sharing them online and started speaking to other people sharing their tasks. And it sort of just spiraled from there, really.
And I think that's what I've written down when I was looking at this topic in particular, and something that I'm really passionate about. And over the last few years, rightly so, we focused on curriculum, its structure, and creating those pathways, especially in the primary sector. So those curriculum journeys that those children navigate are really precise, they're really clear, and we're building that learning over time. So hopefully we can get those deliberate practice, ensure they're encoding it in their long-term memory. But before we talk about task design, I think there's a little bit within this we've got to clarify around lesson structure in some ways, and what we mean by learning as well. So Alex, do you want to give us a little bit about what you think we mean by learning, and then Lauren, feel free to add anything in, and then in a second we'll look about actually what does a typical lesson sequence mean, and hopefully that will give our listeners a bit of context around this before we dive into that.
Brilliant. I love these questions. This is a glorious Friday night. So I think what we've got to really be mindful of is when we talk about learning, we've got to think about it in the context of what the evidence tells us about learning, and resist the myths that are out there that are tempting. And I think one of the things which Lauren and I have been really pushing is what you talked about at the beginning, which is purpose. And we always think about what are the pupils learning as opposed to what are they doing. Now, lots and lots of people will think about the doing part, but the doing doesn't always lead to learning, as Rob Coe has very clearly articulated in those weak proxies for learning. And I always go back to some research from 2014 from Fiorella and Meyer's work. And I don't think I've really settled on this as a mantra for learning. And it's a great staff meeting to run. If you put learning up and say, okay, this is our bread and butter, what as teachers, what or staff in the school, what do we define learning as? And that is so interesting to hear the reach and the range of people's ideas. I'm just going to just remind you what Fiorella and Meyer talk about learning. And they describe it as a process of making sense. And as a starting point, what a brilliant thing to think about. My job as a teacher, my purpose as a teacher, is to help the pupils and students in front of me make sense. And they go on further in to say, in making sense, in which pupils try to understand what is presented to them. Now, that's important to remember. That's the instructional part, where we help pupils and students understand through that instruction. But there are certain components to that that we should think very, very carefully about. And this is why Fiorella and Meyer talk about students actively selecting relevant pieces of information. Now, there's some key parts in that. That word select is really important. And so is relevant, because there is a lot of irrelevant stuff that we still see out there that is gum from clutter, and it's just fluff that is good for distraction. And we know about cognitive load theory. We know about the importance of the focus and attention of the work in memory. If you can't select that relevant piece of information, you can't think hard about it. Now, cognitive psychologists describe the work in memory as a spotlight. Now, isn't that a great way to think about how can I focus that child's spotlight on the relevant piece of information so they can select it? Now, that's active selection. So if they are now attending to that piece of information, they are then paying attention to it. And then we talk about what are they going to think hard about it. And this is where pupils and students need to organise those relevant pieces of information. And so they need to be really thinking hard about them. And that's where we really drop in that task design. So they rehearse, they practice. And I know Lauren is going to be just articulating the lesson sequences in a moment and what the evidence tells us about that. But this is where they have a go to attempt and they make sense of that and they practice. Now, that phase, the organizing phase, is where you've selected, you're organizing your thoughts and you are practicing. And that doesn't bring about perfection. I don't know the quote where this comes from, but it brings about permanence. And we want them to sort of realize that. And this is where we can give feedback to pupils and students so that they can have correctives or they can be challenged further. And the final part that Fiorella and Ma talk about is integrating that knowledge you're acquiring and becoming more sophisticated with existing knowledge and other things that you already know and building that new knowledge and really building those strong schemata. So when we're talking very much about learning, I always go back to Fiorella and Meyer's research about select, organize and integrate. How well do we enable pupils to select the relevant information? How well do we allow them to organize and make sense and process that so that we can encode it into long-term memory? And for that strong schemata, how well do we give them the opportunities to integrate it with other knowledge? So there we are. That's my thinking about learning for starter.
Alex, I agree with all that you've said. I think, James, if we're talking about learning as a change or an alteration in children's long-term memory, we've got to go back and think about what we understand about cognitive load. Cognitive load, it's sort of disingenuous because there's millions of types of cognitive load, but broadly speaking, cognitive load can be grouped into three kind of headline categories. And the types of cognitive load that are generated in our classrooms is really important because as teachers, we're the architects of the cognitive load for our students. And if we can't manage that cognitive load in a way that results in shifts in long-term memory, ultimately we end up with children who might be experiencing learning in the classroom but not taking anything from it. So those sort of three broad categories of cognitive load. We have the intrinsic cognitive load generated by the complexity of the curriculum content itself. Obviously, we want to deliver an ambitious and rich and challenging curriculum. So we want that intrinsic cognitive load. We then have germane cognitive load, which is highly desirable. Germane cognitive load is generated when we connect new learning with our existing understanding. And the reason that it's desirable is because that helps us to remember it over time. So we want to see lots of germane cognitive load in our classrooms. But in terms of extraneous cognitive load, that third umbrella category, extraneous cognitive load essentially is any cognitive load that's generated by potential distractions. So that could be how the information is presented. It could be the resources that are provided for students to select from. It could be the overuse of language from the teacher's explanation, or it could be the dreaded wasp in the back of the classroom. Any of those things will generate extraneous cognitive load. And as teachers, if we are to be the architects of that cognitive load in our classroom, we have to think carefully about keeping the intrinsic cognitive load in the sweet spot between kind of really nourishing and almost too complex. We want to generate lots of germane cognitive load because we want to explicitly identify those connections so that we use children's existing schemas of knowledge to help them make sense of and remember the new content we want to teach. And that means that we've got to strip out, I'm going to steal Alex's term here, the gumph.
Fluff and gump.
Strip out the fluff and gump. We've got to strip out that extraneous distraction so that we can help pupils focus their cognitive attention on curriculum content that we really want them to understand. And when we're thinking about task design, quite often what we see in task design is that the design of the task itself, the process of that task, creates extraneous cognitive distractions, and it stops children in it, you know, in the design of the task itself, from thinking really hard about the concept that we want them to master. So when we're thinking about learning as a change or an alteration in children's long-term memory, what that means is we've got to think deeply about the curriculum content that we're presenting and how that relates to children's existing schemes of knowledge. But we've also got to think really deeply about how we can reduce the extraneous distraction in our task design to focus on the demand of the concept that we're presenting in the first place. So I think that that's really important with when teachers are selecting the vehicles for children to think hard.
And I think there's some really important points here that we're definitely going to go over and explore. And I think one of them is an brilliant example about cognitive load is, there I am with two computers making sure it's running and forgot to actually introduce the three of you properly. So it's a Friday night. So let's go back. This is a perfect example of it. Yeah, exactly.
I think it's the beer sinking in.
Yeah, I haven't actually drunk any of it yet, so I can't even blame on that.
Tea.
Yeah, if only. Right, so Elliot, can you introduce yourself? Log, can you introduce yourself and your role and everything, and Alex? And then afterwards, Elliot, I'm going to come back to you talking about a typical lesson structure, and where do you think task design fits into that? So let's go Lauren first. Let's go Elliot, Lauren, then Alex, and I'll come back to you.
My job title is curriculum advisor, but I work across the primary sphere, sort of delivering CPD, observing teaching, coaching teachers, designing curriculum materials. That's it in a nutshell, really, and based in London.
Thanks. Lauren?
Sorry, James. I'm Lauren Meadows. I used to introduce myself by saying I do all sorts of interesting things until somebody told me that most of what I do is only interesting to me. So now I introduce myself by saying I'm Lauren Meadows and I do lots of things, most of which are only interesting to me. I have the great privilege of being a curriculum advisor for a MAT in the east of England, and work with my wonderful pedagogical twin, Mr. Alex Bedford, to develop curriculum materials and support schools in getting those working really well. And I work with Andy Samways from the Research School, and really getting under the skin of what works in the classroom. So, that's probably broadly what I do.
Broad. Love it.
Fantastic. Go on, Alex. What's your broad
role? Well, it's vast, isn't it? I think I've three incredible jobs. So one is I work for a large MAT with Lauren as the curriculum development director, and that's a real privilege to work with Lauren and lead that partnership around curriculum, teaching and learning. We also publish and we author, and we are always in schools whenever we can. So, yeah, it's very, very privileged job to have, in the sense that we are able to shape and then influence education nationally and internationally. And it's something which we're incredibly proud of.
Excellent. So let's get into the meat and bones now. And then we talk to that context about learning, a little bit about task design. But one of the things we've been thinking about particularly is, where does it fit within this sequence of learning? And quoting Alex earlier, he was saying practice, practice, practice. And when I think about task design, it's particularly after that instruction or that explaining from a teacher. And it's that opportunity that sometimes is missed in school, and we don't give children enough time for that practicing element of it. I'm just wondering what your thoughts are with that, Elliot. And I know that a sequence is not necessarily every lesson you follow this, but where do you see task design really fitting in when there's sequence of learning?
Well, the short answer is throughout. I mean, we were just talking about sort of definitions of learning a moment ago. I guess that ubiquitous definition we have in the profession in the last few years is about this change in long-term memory. But I personally prefer the one from the MPQ framework that talks about it being a lasting change in knowledge and capability. I mean, lasting being that sort of operative word, the word to emphasize there. Like, how do we make that teaching last in memory? Because everything we should do should be born out of that sort of idea. So whether it be managing cognitive load, as Lauren said, sort of spacing tasks out, using retrieval practice, and so on. But that word lasting also acknowledges that forgetting is part of learning. And obviously tasks need to build into that sequence that we need to revisit content or build tasks into the learning sequence where pupils actively have to retrieve that content again. And I think having that sort of shared definition of learning across a school is incredibly important. It's a basis from which everybody can work from and that teaching and learning could be guided. In terms of sort of a lesson structural sequence, I mean, there's many different structures or sequences that can work. I think most would probably, I would hope would agree that any sort of lesson should start with retrieving prior knowledge where possible, because we know that the brain actively seeks to tie new information to what we already know. So at that first sort of instant, do now tasks or starter tasks, as they're commonly known, I guess, is where one place where tasks feature. I mean, I would personally argue that pedagogy should govern your lesson structure. So like if it's direct instruction, that sort of dictates explicit teaching. So in manageable steps, gradually removing that scaffold over time, increasing difficulty slowly. So touching on what you were just saying, James, though, it's that sort of I do, we do, you do phase. I would argue that probably we don't spend enough time in that we do, that does that guided practice. And that's where we need to spend more time. When I think of myself as an NQT, I definitely fell into that trap where I'd model something once, I'd go, okay, great, got it. And then I'd send the pupils off on their way and then quickly discover that no one could really do it. So I think that's one area that we need to spend more time on tasks. Like I think Tom Charrington talks about it as like, you know, like when you're passing a baton over in a relay race, sort of holding onto that baton between the two people, just that little bit longer to make sure that pupils really do have that understanding. And that's where things like worked examples and scaffolding and whatnot come in. But truthfully, any sort of structure is there to tighten up an episode of learning. So it's there as a framework that teachers can operate from, a sort of skeleton for them to add flesh to. And I think when you have a structure, the most important thing is to not stick to it too rigidly, because it's very easy to go into a lesson, have it planned from the very start right to the very end. But we all know that's very rarely how lessons go. So that sort of responsive teaching or adaptive expertise element, the idea of teaching something, questioning, if children haven't got it, then revisiting. So in that sense, I think there are hundreds of sort of mini tasks throughout a lesson. Every time you ask children a question, they have to think. That's arguably a form of task. When they have to speak to a partner for a bit of rehearsal or to question each other or whatever it may be, that's also a task. So it's not just about that independent task or group work task that comes after instruction. There's actually plenty of scope for tasks to be involved during that instructional phase as well.
Excellent. And before we go on to the next bit, which is about the fundamentals of task design, we've got a little message from our
at Bloomsbury sponsor. Education, we're passionate about supporting teachers with high quality professional development books from leading experts. Whether you're navigating your first crucial years as an early career teacher or a more experienced teacher looking to refresh your practice or take a step up into leadership, our award-winning books are here to help. We publish practical books to support teaching across primary and secondary, from the very best in research-led practice to trusted advice on inclusivity, behaviour and curriculum design. Visit the Bloomsbury Education website at bloomsbury.com/education to find out more and use code BLOOMTTR24 to save 20% on all education titles. Bloomsbury Education, books for every step of your teaching journey.
I've always considered myself to be a caring head teacher who acts sensitively to support staff mental health. But what I found increasingly difficult was managing the negative impact on staff mental health when resolving issues related to their employment or daily work. Heartfelt Leadership has been developed by TeachWell Toolkit as a handbook to support head teachers to overcome the challenges of school improvement while supporting staff well-being. We know that difficult conversations can quickly turn into conflict if procedures are not fully transparent, understood, and followed. Our handbook takes you through step-by-step processes while maintaining mutual respect, avoiding conflict, and finding solutions.
So now we've provided that context and that foundation about learning, about sequencing, and about this idea of practice, practice, practice. And then we're going to go over later talking about how we can reduce that cognitive load. And I know all three of you got some fantastic examples I've seen and heard you talk about before. But what are those fundamentals of when a teacher is planning a task, whether it's through the WeDo or independent or how it works, what are those fundamentals that they need to think of and consider when planning that? And Lauren, I'll start with you and then feel free, Elliot or Alex, to add on afterwards.
Thanks, James. Elliot, I think you made some really important points there. You said every time a teacher asks a question, it's creating a task of sorts, and that's sort of exactly what I mean about being the architect of cognitive load in the classroom, because every time there's an interaction between teacher and student, that the cognitive load that's generated has the potential to either provide great richness in its ability to enhance their understanding, or to provide a distraction, that extraneous distraction to be the fluff and gump that distracts students from understanding that. So the task design piece is really crucial. I think that there are several fundamentals. How it fits into your lesson is crucial, but recognizing that every student will experience that lesson structure differently. So for some students, you know, one worked example may be enough. For others, you know, it may be guided practice all the way through, but the essence of them all experiencing success is vital. When teachers are sitting down to plan tasks, and you know, this is something that Alex and I work with teachers all day, every day on, the crucial part is really thinking about how to minimise that extraneous cognitive load. And we do that by minimising the amount of cognitive attention that's got to be directed at the process of the task, so that we can maximise the focus on the content that we want to teach. And something that we found really successful is having a small number of task designs or devices that we can deploy across multiple lessons that students learn how to engage with. And so when they meet those task designs across different lessons or at different points in different lessons, they don't have to expend their cognitive attention on working out what they've got to do. And instead, that allows them to free up the precious mental capacity to think about the concept itself. So we work with a series of what we call thinking hard devices. And so we encourage teachers to use strategies like labelling, ordering, ranking, matching and sorting. And what we're able to do is to really promote great quality discussion, to build in high quality vocabulary, to build in opportunities to use those strategies for checking for understanding. And then, as Elliot quite rightly said, to increase the focus on practice where it's needed. And by minimising the number of different task designs that pupils will meet across the school day, it increases their opportunity to really think hard about the intrinsically demanding concepts. So I think my kind of number one fundamental of task design is to minimise extraneous distraction. And the number two is therefore to keep the devices that you use to encourage children to think hard to a minimum, so that they learn the routines of how to execute that. I'm sure Alex will have some other gems though.
So that minimising distractions and keeping those devices to think. And it goes back to seeing some maths curriculum where you get a problem or you get something, and you get so many variation of it. And there is some really good research around variation theory and how it looks, but yeah, that goes to the depth. Whereas this is actually that practice element of it. And I think that pedagogical understanding is absolutely essential. And that matching and that sorting and that labeling are intrinsically actually quite cognitive. When they get used to those, quite quick and quite easy. So the focus is on that learning. And I think that whole conversation we've had about cognitive science over the last few years has been able, that the education sector has been able to think about this a lot more intuitively, which is exciting. Elliot, yeah, what are your... Go on, Lauren.
Sorry, I was going to say, James, if I'm honest, I started my career, you know, about 3,000 years ago, where we used to write pirates in the middle of the page and come up with all of the ideas of nice activities we could do about pirates. Thankfully, we've sort of learned since then. We've moved on, haven't we? But there's a really crucial part there, isn't there? This slight friction between, children having the opportunity to thrive and be creative, and teachers having the opportunity to provide stimulating learning experiences, with this idea of routines around learning, routines particularly around task design, being boring. But there's, the great Peps McRae quote around, routines freeing up the precious mental capacity needed to think creatively. And I really subscribe to that idea. What we see every day in schools, and Alex and I work in some really challenging areas, is children being, almost deeply thankful that they know how to be successful in a task within a lesson, and them having this opportunity to assimilate knowledge, which allows them to have something to think hard about. And that friction between, is routine boring? Are we, are we sucking the kind of creativity out of education? It's impossible to be creative if you haven't got that kind of basis of knowledge and experience to work from in the first place. So, I really subscribe to this idea of routines in learning.
And I also think with that idea of restrictions, it actually forces creativity, because you have boundaries, and we know children like boundaries. They behave well in those boundaries, and what it is, it makes children and teachers in some ways explore something in a more of a depth than they would previously. And so, let's say it's a really quite a strange tangent, but if you think about the four chord song, four chords, many songs you create from that, and that's everyone being creative with quite a limited palette and what they've done there. And it is exactly the same kind of concept with anything we do, and sometimes it's you're focusing on other areas. Elliot, what are your thoughts around this in terms of some of the fundamentals of what makes great task design?
The one I sort of hinted at earlier, which I think is probably for me the most fundamental, is understanding that instruction and task are sort of inextricably linked, and any task that ignores or doesn't link to instruction is sort of doomed to fail. And I know that sounds painfully obvious to say, but I'm sure we've all provided our students with tasks before that didn't really marry up with our instruction, and then they've sort of failed with their learning as a result. And I think novice teachers are perhaps a little bit more susceptible to that. I think the design of a task, it obviously requires quite significant thought and devotion of time, because it's got to marry up a multitude of things, like the instructional goals of the curriculum, the subject content, the pedagogy of the teacher, the disciplinary practice of the subject, cognitive theories that support learning, like cognitive load, as Lauren was saying. In the broadest possible sense, that the purpose of a task is the application of knowledge, and be that at the start of learning, be that at the end when it's revision or whatever it may be, that's it. That is the purpose of a task in its broadest sense. And in any task that doesn't facilitate application of knowledge in some form is probably, in my mind, falling short of the mark. I think another thing to consider is whether subjects can be detached from the tasks that are employed to elucidate their content. I would argue that they can. Well, no, I'd say they probably can't for the most part. While there might be some tasks that we can use across subjects, we need to think about how that specific task elucidates the content within that subject. So the design of a task plays a pivotal role in shaping how the learner engages with and interprets that subject matter. As Alex was saying earlier with the Ferrello and Mayer, that SOI model around sort of selecting and organizing it and so on. I think Graham Nuttall said in his book, The Hidden Lives of Learners, something along the lines of like learning doesn't come from the tasks. It comes from the way that students experience or engage with those tasks. And obviously that application can look very different in different subjects. So in language mm-hmm. teaching, there'll be a lot more sort of.
Oh,
hello.
Yeah. Go on, Alex. Do you want to take that on and we'll see?
I'll carry that on. I mean, Elliot's talking sense. It's great to talk with people that make sense. Obviously, Lauren, you make sense all the time. So I'm thinking here about when you think about task design, right? We always ask ourselves, what purpose does this task serve? And whenever I'm designing a task, I remove that temptation to think, what will they do? Because the doing part is not the thing that I need to think about. I need to think about how will I help them learn? And the question that I ask people is, how well does learning endure from that task as a result? So I'm just going to dial back a bit to those lesson sequences, which is really important. And there is this notion of pace. And we do see this, and what Lauren and I are desperately trying to do, and we are bringing this into the forefront of teachers' pedagogical routines, is that we need to allow children to attempt to make sense of the things you are teaching them, and we chunk it up into smaller, broken-down parts, and we allow them time to think. We give them those opportunities to think hard. But too often, we move from the instructional phase, where we might have followed a pedagogical routine where we've connected with prior learning, we've given explanations and clear examples, but then we can be almost driven to say, right, get it in your books. And there's the problem, is because between that instructional part, what we need to offer is an opportunity within those phases, and Elliot's quite right, it's a guide, if you like, is to really allow children to attempt to make sense of it. And that's where we can build that endurance of memory. Today, I was privileged to be in two schools today. And in the second school, I was running structured conversations with pupils, getting them to explain their memory and learning of learning from the autumn term. And it was an absolute joy to hear them select, organise their thoughts, integrate it with existing knowledge and be able to articulate with nothing in front of them what they knew and what they know and how they were connecting that. And it is a thing of great joy to hear that. That's really one of the mechanisms to find out how well does learning endure. And that's when I've introduced these conversations with Claire Seeley when she was a head teacher in Tower Hamlets. And she described that process as being as though the scales fell from her eyes. She said, it's simple to do, but it takes a lot of skill. And that's what we need to ask ourselves. How well does learning endure? Not are we giving them tasks? The task design is exactly what Lauren is talking about, ensuring that we have some variation, but a set of devices we use, we can increase the sophistication, and through our question and challenge and scaffold, all pupils get a chance to think hard.
Excellent. Elliot, are you back with us?
Yes. If you can all hear me, I didn't realise it cut out, so I was probably just waxing lyrical to myself in a room.
There, we can hear you.
I mean, Alex has sort of summed up everything I was saying there. I guess the only thing, I don't know where it cut off, but I was talking about the idea that we need to, when we're, especially in primary, because we're jacks of all trade, aren't we? We're generalists. And what a task might look like in PE is different to what a task might look like in languages or maths or so on. So, and because of that, task design isn't an exact science, that there's no comprehensive guide to getting a task right. We can only have sort of guiding principles that we can generalize across subjects like managing cognitive load. And that's the sort of thing we need to think about, because task design is not a linear process. It's something we need to revisit the task after it's been implemented. Did it work? Why did it work? Why didn't it work? And view that as a sort of ongoing or cyclical process. I have like four principles that from my own reading that I just sort of established a couple of years ago that I always use when I'm thinking about tasks. The first being, does it align with sort of the instructional intentions? What is it I'm trying to teach? Or what is it that I want to endure here, as Alex was saying? The second being attention. So how am I sort of within the task itself, how am I guiding attention, but also around the task implementation? How am I reducing attentional demand? How am I preventing distraction from peers? The third principle being motivation. So building in that idea of success, students need to feel success to feel motivated to do tasks in the future. If I keep giving them times tables tests and they don't know their times tables, they're not going to want to do them. And then the last one being cognitive demand. So what Lauren has been talking about, but also the idea of, well, recognizing that task place cognitive demand on learners, but also thinking about how can we tweak that level of demand to increase challenge, which I'm sure we're going to discuss later.
Yes, and I think that's the thing about the motivation, the cognitive demand, and that challenge is something that, yeah, we can explore in a little bit. But I know, Alex, you're going to go soon, but there's a question that I want to ask you. And it's, I think, one of the reasons why I wanted to bring you on. And it's as simple as, what role do you think technology has with task design? And the reason why I say this is that if you think about how education has ebbed and flowed, we've had back in the Victorians, we had slate boards, we had interactive whiteboards, but how we actually showcase our learning and through writing hasn't necessarily changed that much. Okay. And with technology coming to the forefront, with more and more schools using it, where do you see the role of technology within this?
That's a great question. It's one Lauren and I have been really digging into, and we are very clear about our beliefs based upon cognitive science and neuroscientific understanding around the role of technology. Now, one of the tragedies which I see sort of unfolding is that we've got it completely the wrong way around in many places. And that's where technology and apps influence the decision making around how they're used in schools. And that is the wrong way around. And we're seeing technology being used for the sake of technology. And when we go back to the principles of cognitive science, what do we want to do? Well, we want to activate attention. And we want to activate that attention without too much content, without too much clutter, and we don't want to split the attention. And that's where there are sort of a couple of avenues I want to explore here around digital technology. And the key to this is to ask the question, what purpose does technology serve? And the thing that Lauren and I have stood firm with is that technology doesn't drive your curriculum. Your curriculum is enhanced by technology where appropriate. And there are helpful ways that it can be used, and there can be unhelpful ways. And what we're starting to see, and Lauren and I were speaking at Research Ed in Cambridge a few weeks ago, and I met you at Gloucester, and Tim Oates was talking there, and they were talking around curriculum, and Tom Bennett was talking around sort of the culture of schools. And this Frankenstein effect has been really sort of talked about bolt-ons, the way that we can bolt on technology and we're just doing it because it's a thing. And that's where we are not going to do that. Technology has to enhance and support children's attention and only used where appropriate. It has to help children process and think hard. It can be used to as a device to ensure that children have the opportunities to quickly and precisely access tasks, and they can then rehearse, they can use those tasks. So, I mean, Lauren and I are in an incredible position where we are building tasks which can be deployed digitally to classes by teachers. And those tasks and those devices are really well chosen, and those are written by curriculum experts. And those tasks are then used, and those tasks are embedded and intrinsic to the curriculum. The curriculum drives the content. the curriculum drives the task, and then technology is able then to support us in being more efficient with it instead of leading us. We use technology for our enhancement, and think of it as a learning tool as opposed to I'm using it because I've been told to. So I'll give you an example. So pupils are practicing and beginning in the lesson, year six, physical processes in geography. They are becoming a little more expert around the four layers of the earth and thinking hard around that, and then bringing in their understanding of that, and then sophisticating and getting them a little more expert, and then their knowledge is deepening. And there are lots of devices which we've created to help with that. So one of the devices is to label the four layers of the earth. But don't do it once. Once is never enough. We always say, you know, do it three times. And what we're talking about here is fluency. We want them to become fluent with that early acquisition of knowledge so that they can then elaborate upon it, and we can increase the cognitive challenge, the cognitive and the sophistication of it. And that will allow those pupils to deepen that memory, and that memory will be encoded into long-term memory. So we'll deploy a task around labeling the layers of the earth, and pupils will practice it. Now, that reduces teacher workload. Pupils only use digital technology at that point for that thing. And Lauren and I are committed that there is an absolute place for repurposing books. Books are still important. Writing is important. That connection, that elaboration, that thinking aloud, and that pride is something which we won't give away. So technology and digital books, we have seen some incredibly poor examples of learning. And the proof is, does learning endure as a result? So if you've got multiple places where you're storing things, aren't you enacting the split attention effect? Aren't you increasing those loads that are not desired? So there's just a few examples of how digital technology in the right hands with the right principles, which is all based around research-led practice, then it's got a place. What we don't want to have are these fads and trends about doing stuff. I've been really privileged this week to be, you know, Claire Seeley's contacted me about the things we're doing and is really interested in how we are taking this forward in a cognitive science point of view. That's what we're about, is using the evidence of the research to inform our decision making and making conscious and deliberate decisions around task design and where it's appropriate with technology and where it's not.
And I often use a phrase that where can technology be the vehicle for good pedagogy? And it's that's the key element of it. It's the fact that technology can help with decoding for children who need to listen to something, but a human voice, I think that's really important. Languages, it's an extremely good example, but it's that instant feedback. It's the fact that you are not cutting and sticking and all the mess is on the floor and you've got scissors everywhere, and actually what is the key element of learning that goes back to that three principle point we were talking at the beginning. And it's we see, all three of us probably see good examples, but also within our, we've also seen probably not so good examples. And I think that is, it's something to get across to others. And I think going back to another Peps and McCree element is teachers need to get something. They need to see it before they can own it. And I think that restriction in what makes good tasks or how we use technology will help that as a vehicle.
Mm, absolutely.
So, Alex, thank you very much for the beginning of the show and the conversations. I will let you go because I know you had a very busy week. I'll move on to the news.
Thank you, everyone. I'll just say goodbye and thank you, Lauren. I'll catch up with you soon. Elliot, it's been a privilege to talk with you. James, it was great to speak to you last week. And my curfew starts now. So Mrs. B has...
is she knocking at the door?
She's basically saying
she's beating that down.
I will be in trouble. Take care, everyone. See you all soon. Lauren, do your magic.
Take care.
See you.
Take care. Bye.
I've always considered myself to be a caring head teacher who acts sensitively to support staff mental health. But what I found increasingly difficult was managing the negative impact on staff mental health when resolving issues related to their employment or daily work. Heartfelt Leadership has been developed by TeachWell Toolkit as a handbook to support head teachers to overcome the challenges of school improvement while supporting staff well-being. We know that difficult conversations can quickly turn into conflict if procedures are not fully transparent, understood, and followed. Our handbook takes you through step-by-step processes while maintaining mutual respect, avoiding conflict, and finding solutions.
At Bloomsbury Education, we're passionate about supporting teachers with high-quality professional development books from leading experts. Whether you're navigating your first crucial years as an early career teacher or a more experienced teacher looking to refresh your practice or take a step up into leadership, our award-winning books are here to help. We publish practical books to support teaching across primary and secondary, from the very best in research-led practice to trusted advice on inclusivity, behaviour and curriculum design. Visit the Bloomsbury Education website at bloomsbury.com/education to find out more and use code BLOOMTTR24 to save 20% on all education titles. Bloomsbury Education, books for every step of your teaching journey.
This is Teachers Talk Radio, and this is Teachers Talk Radio News.
BBC News reports that MI5 has briefed vice-chancellors from 24 universities across the UK on the threat from foreign states which could undermine national security. The vice-chancellors were warned that cutting-edge research could be targeted by states seeking to boost their own militaries and economies. The Deputy Prime Minister has also announced a consultation on measures to protect UK universities. There has been no direct reference to any one state, but the government has previously warned that China could be gaining influence in British academic research. The institutions involved in the briefing included Oxford, Cambridge, and Imperial College London. The head of the Russell Group said its members take their national security responsibilities incredibly seriously. The chief executive of Universities UK said the body has worked with government for several years. The latest particular threat could be to academic research that has a potential dual use in civilian and military life. The Guardian features the topic of Ofsted one-word judgments as it appears in the news once again. Reaction to the news features prominently in the article, with primary focus given to the views of Professor Julia Waters, sister of Ruth Perry. Ms. Perry's death following an Ofsted inspection prompted a review of a range of aspects of the inspection process, with one-word judgments a main focus of interest. In a statement published on the 25th of April, the government has ruled that the judgments are here to stay. Professor Waters described the government's response to an inquiry by the Commons Education Committee as woefully inadequate. Teaching unions had backed calls for the scrapping of the single word judgments and of more radical reform to the inspectorate in England. The announcement came as something of a shock, as days earlier the Sunday Times had published a story suggesting the single word judgment would likely be scrapped. Government have stated that the headline grades provide a succinct and accessible summary for parents, and that they enable government to look at inspection outcomes across England. The statement went on to say they would continue to listen as part of the Big Listen public consultation, although many have criticised the wording of some of the questions, which appear to prevent clear, critical feedback. It seems that funding for education isn't just a hot topic for the UK. The BBC Latin American news site reports on protests in Buenos Aires as thousands of people took to the streets to demand increased funding for public universities. Argentina's president came to office in 2023 and vowed to take a chainsaw to public spending and justified the cuts by calling the state-run universities centres of socialist indoctrination. Ricardo Gelpi, rector of University of Buenos Aires, says the institution may have to close within 3 months without more funding. Pictures from the demonstration show tens of thousands of protesters dancing, playing instruments and holding banners. The BBC also report on a World Health Organization report which shows that a third of 11-year-olds and more than half of 13-year-olds in England have drunk alcohol. Girls were found to be more likely than boys to be drinking and getting drunk age 15 in England, Wales and Scotland. The World Health Organization called on countries to introduce more measures to protect children. The report looked at data from 4,500 school-aged children from each country in Europe, Central Asia and Canada between 2021 and 22. The focus was on use of cigarettes, vaping, alcohol and cannabis among adolescents. The UK has always had relatively high alcohol use amongst young people, but it has been declining. On cannabis use, the report found more boys in Scotland had used the drug compared to all other countries. No data was provided for England. Smoking is much less common, but the report confirmed that vaping rates have overtaken it in most countries and are above average in the UK. Full details of the report can be found on the BBC website. Finally, Cambridge University's Fitzwilliam College has apologised to students after housekeeping staff allegedly embarrassed one individual by posting images of their messy room. Pictures of the communal areas and a bedroom were emailed around the college as an illustration of what housekeeping staff don't want to see. But the college has since apologised, saying the inclusion of the image of a bedroom was unacceptable and an invasion of privacy. Students had also complained that they were being woken up and asked to tidy communal areas too early, although the college says it has stopped this practice in response to feedback. This has been your Teachers Talk Radio News with Joe Fox.
Hello and welcome back to Teachers Talk Radio. We've got Lauren and we've got Elliot here, who's going to talk now about challenge. Because we've been talking about tasks, we've been talking about how they can make sure they make changes in our long-term memory. We've talked about learning in particular and some of the aspects of what makes good tasks and the fundamental principles behind those. But there is also that scope of we don't want to give tasks to pupils that they can just do. So, Elliot, I know you've done a lot of work on this recently. So, not a simple question, but how do we define challenge?
Yeah, so I have done a lot of reading around this this area. The reason being is that, I think it's a very ill-defined concept in education. And I think back to myself again as an NQT, showing my mentor my lesson plans and always hearing the question, how are you going to push the hires? And I always struggled with that question because I felt that all children should be challenged, but I also didn't know what exactly challenge actually looked like in the classroom. Is it the amount of time we give for a task? Is it the amount of effort or cognitive demand that we expect the learner to sort of expend? Is it the number of steps involved in a task? Is it the complexity of knowledge that they have to access? Is it all of those things, something else? So I sort of went down a bit of a rabbit hole and funnily enough, I still haven't come to sort of a simple and quick definition or concise definition of what challenge is. In fact, I've got sort of many bullet points that sort of define it for me. One interesting thing is I was rereading Daniel Willingham's Why Don't Students Like School? And he talks about in that book about how humans actually appear to enjoy challenging things. The things that the reason like we do like crosswords, Sudoku, those sort of things, or play video games on the hardest setting, is that we do take some enjoyment from that level of challenge. But obviously, success being tied to that, if we're not successful in those things, then obviously we lose motivation or enjoyment from them. Another thing that's important to recognize is that learning itself is challenging and unavoidably so. If we think about that sort of simple model of memory, the idea of like there's information in the environment competing for our attention, we have sort of limited capacity for attention and for processing information and so on and so on. All of those stages within or the elements within that simple model of memory suggest that learning itself is inherently challenging. It is inherently difficult and unavoidably so. So challenge involves.
Oh, we've lost Elliot again there. Lauren, I wonder if you could. Oh, yeah, you're back again.
Yeah. Sorry, if that cuts out, please just, yeah, do go to Lauren. But I was saying that that challenge involves placing a cognitive demand on the learner. And Reef has this equation of like cognitive load as the relationship between task demands and available resources. So a task could be incredibly challenging, but people could have a wealth of available resources. So working memory capacity, prior knowledge and so on, which makes the task less challenging. And sort of like conversely, you could have a task where, well, the task demands are very high, but the learner doesn't have those available resources. So it's about thinking about that balance between those two things. If I were to try and summarize challenge in sort of a single sentence, I'd perhaps say that it is when prior knowledge meets unfamiliar context, where we sort of try and get pupils to transfer what they've learned or what they already know to an unfamiliar context. And in that sense, challenge can be viewed as a form of progression in learning. When we first learn information, it's very inflexible, it's shallow knowledge, but through challenging tasks over time, we can make that knowledge deeper, we can make it more flexible, we can apply it to different contexts. I'd be interested to hear what your thoughts are on that, Lauren, how you would go about defining challenge.
I think you've done an amazing job. And in fact, the sort of words I'm scribbling down on a pad in front of me came out of your mouth as I was writing them, Elliot. So maybe there's some kind of weird curriculum mental sphere that we're all connected to. I think about defining challenge, Alex talked earlier about integrating, selecting, organising and integrating knowledge. And one of the things I feel really conscious of when I'm in classrooms, and in fact I teach frequently myself, so I'm conscious of it myself as a practitioner, is the desire to move the lesson on. And when we're thinking about introducing a level of challenge, whatever that word means, in the classroom, we have to encourage teachers to kind of embrace that struggle, because it's in that struggle that the magic happens, isn't it? It's in the struggle that that children think hard, and when children think hard, they, you know, make better sense of and commit to their long-term memory the concepts that they're thinking hard about in the ideal. For me, I think what you're describing, Elliot, is the difference between procedural fluency and conceptual fluency. So knowing, you know, procedural fluency to be able to execute a process efficiently and accurately, that's the sort of fluency that we'd expect to see in what Alex was describing as the attempt phase of the lesson, where we move gradually from guided practice to deliberate practice, where we're building fluency with the acquired knowledge or capability. In terms of challenge, what we really want children to do, as Elliot beautifully put it, is to apply that knowledge and to think about the competency that they've learned deeply and flexibly. And that's what we mean by challenge, isn't it? That the move from being procedurally fluent in the acquisition of a knowledge or a capability through to being conceptually fluent, where there's such a deep sense of understanding around the concept that you can apply it in multiple contexts, you can ignore the extraneous distractions. And that really comes back to this idea of where you can generate challenge or where you can dial challenge down to avoid cognitive overload. And so I think the two strands for really generating challenge come in the intrinsic demand of the concept itself. So that could be how much of the concept is released or instructed at any given point, to what degree or what gradient of understanding a concept is instructed, and how complex, how intrinsically complex the concept is in itself. And then the other strand that we look to for really generating that challenge, if you want, is our germain cognitive load. That's where your select, organise and integrate comes in. That if we're able to really extend children's thinking to build new knowledge into their existing schemas of understanding, in that area, that's where we're going to really generate that challenge to look at how children connect understanding over time. So I completely agree with everything that Elliot said. Particularly about, you know, moving from procedural fluency to conceptual fluency. And I think as a teacher, when we're looking at how to generate that challenge, it either comes through the intrinsic demand and presentation of that concept itself, or through our expectations about how our children are connecting what they've just learned with their existing schemas of understanding. So I'm not sure that answers the question any better than Elliot had already given, but a different take on it perhaps.
And I've written down, embrace that struggle. That's where the magic happens. And I think that's really key if we put that down. But there is a danger of being too much struggle. And it's that balancing and moving it forward and backwards. So what are some of those tangible tasks or challenges that you've done where it's worked really effectively, or where you've had to feel like you've had to pull that challenge back because whether the children's resilience isn't there, or you misjudged their prior learning or something like that. Examples that we've all had, we've all delivered a lesson where actually it was a disaster. Basically, there was something there, it was too much of a challenge. Or as Elliot said earlier, our task doesn't align with actually our instruction and there's a mismatch. But let's think about that challenge. What are some of those tangible ideas that you've seen that you can challenge pupils, but also pull it back? Elliot, I'll start with you.
I don't have any sort of individual specific tasks that come to mind. They're just a sort of series of sort of events, I guess, that have happened with those tasks where they may have failed. I think a very common thing that I see when I observe teachers, and I'm certainly have been guilty of it myself, is that in recent years, we've focused very heavily on retrieval practice or on retrieval and for the betterment of teaching generally. But if we think about those sort of three processes of learning, of encoding, storage and retrieval, often we're jumping into retrieval before knowledge is securely encoded enough. And then we wonder why that the retrieval practice itself is falling short. And then we're perhaps thinking, oh, is it because of the way this retrieval practice has been designed as a task, and not considering that whether children have actually had the chance to encode that knowledge in the first place. So a very important thing is to ensure that sort of foundational content, or like procedural fluency or conceptual fluency, as Lauren was saying, is secure to that point of fluency, and making sure that children have that knowledge, that requisite knowledge, before we then go to challenge them. Of course, we can challenge pupils at any stage of learning, but what that challenge looks like is very different at the start of learning compared to what it looks like towards the end of learning. That sort of progression I mentioned earlier. Towards the end of learning, it's going to be a lot more like transfer into unfamiliar or new context. At the start of learning, it's about how quickly we remove that scaffold, or we gradually increase the level of difficulty. So that's where things like desirable difficulties come into play, which are a very counterintuitive finding in education. This idea that we can slow down the process of learning and that it actually benefits long-term retention. So the idea of varying the conditions of study and practice instead of keeping them very familiar and predictable, interleaving study or instruction on different topics, spacing sessions rather than sort of just blocking or massing them together, and then taking advantage of like the testing effect rather than just sort of reteaching or revisiting knowledge. Another thing I think I've been very guilty of in the past is when I've put that sort of challenging task in front of pupils, that I've seen that they've struggled, and then I've just over scaffolded and I've immediately reduced the level of challenge straight away, rather than thinking about how can I think of a scaffold now, a prompt that I might say or a scaffold that I might give them that enables them to access this challenge. So a useful thing to do is when expert teachers will consider this sort of implicitly or subconsciously, that they don't even necessarily realize they're doing it, but thinking about what we call enabling and extending prompts. So when you have this challenging task and thinking, okay, some children might struggle with this, when they struggle with it, what am I going to say in that moment that's going to enable them to be able to access the task or to continue with it? And then likewise, some children might breeze through this task because obviously varying levels of prior knowledge, and in that case then, what extending prompt am I going to give? So what prompt am I going to give that extends their thinking on this specific context and task, rather than just giving them an entirely new task? how am I going to challenge them to think deeper around this concept or whatever it may be? And additional adults, if you're fortunate enough to have additional adults in the room, I think it's very important that we train them around the sort of providing those optimal conditions that we want, training them what to say and do. We don't want them to over scaffold in the moment. We want them to be able to recognize when pupils can work independently and to take that moment to sort of step back. But also, on the other hand, the notice when the child is struggling and they do need support, but what that support should look like. And I think the EEF have a good sort of like pyramid graphic for this where it talks about like cluing and prompting. So things like, oh, what did Mrs. Johnson say to you that could help you here? Or there's a ruler on your table. How can the ruler support you? So thinking about how we don't just reduce that level of challenge when we panic in the immediate, but thinking about how we can scaffold up so that pupils can access it. I guess that's sort of my answer to it in a very long roundabout way.
And I think that tangible element of training is a key thing here about how can you scaffold up. It's something I'll come back to at the end. I always ask my guests, so I'll give you a 10-minute warning here, is what's that one tangible thing that you'd want to give teachers to go away with? Because we've clearly all thought about this in a lot of depth. And with the demands of teaching, and we've been guilty of it, we just pick up a lesson, we go with it, falls flat on its face, and you move on to the next one. And actually, we're doing children a disservice. We shouldn't be doing that. So what are some... you'll come at the end and have a chance to think about what are those tangible things. But Lauren, where's that challenge that you've seen and some examples of the tasks that you may have written or taught or used that you've seen really insightful, really enlightening, and some of those techniques as well that building on what Elliot just shared with us?
I think you picked up a great example earlier of where task design is less successful, if you like. You sort of mentioned the idea of cutting and sticking something and then it fails because we're all focused on the cutting and sticking. And that's exactly what I'm talking about, you know, the process over content. And so the reality of task design is that any task design that focuses people's cognitive attention too much on the process or the act of the task itself rather than the concept is going to fall a bit short. Likewise, any task design that is, perhaps lacking in good quality structure, so the kind of open research model that we know often results in children copying out long, inaccurate passages from dodgy websites. We know that, you know, structure, routine, all of that brings kind of real purpose and focus to the design of tasks. In terms of tangible tasks, I'm thinking of a lesson that I taught very recently in a school in Norfolk, and they were struggling particularly with task design in editing lessons in writing. And I think this is a really a kind of good concrete example, if you like, of where the task design itself is so broad that pupils don't understand how to be successful within it. So essentially, they were kind of modelling the process of editing multiple aspects of children's written work and then having modelled the process of doing that with a teacher-led piece of writing. Children were then asked to go and edit their own work. And what they were finding was it wasn't resulting in children making, you know, good quality adaptations to their writing. So what we did was we looked instead at breaking down the lesson into the concepts that children had not been successful at. And instead of just modelling how to correct that, recognising that some children may need some reteaching of that in micro form. And so putting together almost a kind of micro lesson that moved children through understanding and recognising the error, the reteaching of the concept, the application of the correction strategy to the point of fluency, that kind of procedural fluency. And then the task design was the editing itself, but just through that one lens of, for example, sustaining a verb tense. And then shifting children's attention to a different aspect of editing the same passage of writing, but through a different lens, moving through that position of the reteach, the rehearsal to the point of procedural, the application of that to conceptual fluency. And the outcomes from that were that structure were much stronger. And I think possibly for two reasons. Firstly, we'd zoomed right into the very specific limiting factor in children assimilating that concept. But secondly, we'd recognised the need to build greater procedural fluency. And Elliot talked just now about requisite knowledge. Asking children to edit a piece of writing when they haven't got the requisite knowledge to do so, or they have the requisite knowledge but it's insufficiently procedurally fluent, is you know, really a bit of a hiding to nothing. Elliot also talked about the process of preparing to teach, and I think this is where the biggest gains are to be had in the education sector. We have a very specific scaffolding toolkit which provides teachers with 10 strategies that they learn and rehearse and apply across multiple contexts. So that instead of having that moment of thinking, gosh, how am I going to scaffold or challenge as is needed, they have the opportunity to plot those scaffolding strategies directly into the lesson as they're rehearsing their exposition, as they're planning, they're checking for understanding. And what we found is two things. So the first is that it's reduced cognitive load for teachers in the decision-making process for how they will support children to really think hard and to scaffold them in the process. And in doing so, it's made teachers' application much more precise of strategies that will generate good quality learning. The second is the EEF piece that Elliot is mentioning about the principles of least help first. In that we're fine jumping straight to, diminishing the challenge, the intrinsic challenge in the curriculum content itself. Teachers are much more adept at tuning into scaffolding strategies that will work in different contexts or with different pupils. And the really exciting part of that is that it's generative. So by nature, when we deliver the curriculum, we learn more about which parts of it work and which parts of it don't. And so we're learning where the most high utility strategies are for scaffold and challenge, and where the most high impact strategies are. And that's helping us to refine the toolkit over time. So I think, it comes back a little bit to the principle of, routines for teachers, being able to deploy those precisely and efficiently, and thinking really carefully about the structure that sits behind the presentation of the task design, so that there's an opportunity for every young person to be successful, regardless of their entry point to that lesson.
And I think one of our penultimate things that we've talked about, that scaffolding, and I think it's probably key that you both mentioned earlier, is this idea of minimizing distraction and making sure that cognitive demand isn't too much. So what are some of those practical steps teachers can take to make sure they focus on that more meaningful learning experience rather than that compliance and box ticking that doesn't necessarily align with the curriculum or with the instruction? Elliot, I'll start with you.
That is a great question, not one that I'm sure I can answer too well. One thing that immediately came to mind as you were talking about that, though, is because obviously we're talking a lot about the actual design of tasks, but for me, task design should also always factor in the actual implementation of the task. So actually thinking about when I implement this in the classroom, the conditions in place, what I'm going to say, what I expect from the learners and so on. So poor proxies for learning is an important thing to consider. Not so much necessarily avoiding them, because they themselves are not in direct contradiction to learning. You know, pupils putting their hands up, writing lots, talking to each other. Those things aren't in contradiction to learning. They're just not evidence alone that learning is occurring. So one thing is to acknowledge that those things exist, and that we sort of perhaps subconsciously bias those things as evidence, and not falling for those things as evidence. But on the contrary to that, is thinking, sort of trying to look for and identify when perhaps learning isn't happening. So Gaffer Cole and Alloway have their work in memory failures. They talk about sort of incomplete recall, failing to follow instructions, placekeeping errors, task abandonment. Those are things that we should be monitoring as we're sort of walking around the classroom, tracking, learning, listening to pupils' answers and whatnot. And that can be evidence that the learning that we are intending to happen isn't happening quite how we've intended it to, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and especially though it is those poor proxies for learning, isn't it? It's that whole picture of that implementation. Lauren, what are your thoughts around these poor proxies for learning?
They're incredibly useful to help us be aware of when children are masking essentially a learning experience. So you know, there's something that Alex and I talk about a huge amount across our partnership of schools, to be alert to them, I suppose, as Elliot said. He talked a little bit about kind of how do we minimize distractions and how do we avoid those poor proxies for learning where children look and sound a bit like they're learning, but actually there's no thinking, or certainly no thinking hard, going on behind the scenes. I think there's various areas that we can win on this, James. So one of the big areas is teachers' exposition. It absolutely delights me to see quite a significant shift in the profession of teachers spending time, instead of scrapping around for, you know, resources, preparing resources for lessons, or trying to find a worksheet with a, you know, some kind of tangible link to whatever it is they want to teach. Instead, we've moved into this delicious phase of teachers beginning to rehearse their explanations and to think carefully about precision and concision. And that definitely is a way that we can minimise distractions. Alex and I have just finished a big 2-year EEF study looking at very specific task design and structures for explicit vocabulary instruction. And within that, we look at kind of scripted, consistent exposition, and the gains to be had in that area are huge. So that's definitely, you know, one area that we can minimise distraction. And of course, with that comes the chunking of information. How do we avoid, you know, children not really engaging with the entirety of the concept that we want them to understand through the way that we present it, the pace, the release of information, and that tight exposition? And then, of course, you know, it'd be remiss if we didn't talk about lesson materials. Too often we create extraneous cognitive distraction through the way that we present our lesson materials, whether that's a small ladybird crawling across the bottom of a screen, or an oversaturation of images or vocabulary, or creating the split attention effect by asking pupils to look between too many different documents. All of those create that distraction. And while it might make children look really busy, as you know, the age-old cutting and sticking makes children look really busy, actually, you know, we're then directing our attention at the administration of the lesson rather than the deep consideration of the concepts that we're presenting. So, you know, some things to think about, and sometimes that requires habitual change from teachers, you know, habitual change in the way that we've always presented our lesson materials, or habitual change in how much information we put on a slide. I think all of those considerations are, you know, fairly tangible for teachers.
Yeah, and both of you have got some really good clear points that people can take away, listen, and think about in particular. But before we finish, we're going to have a little bit from our sponsors. And the final question, so you two have probably got about 30 seconds to think of your answer, is what's that one, and it has to be one, I'm going to put that demand on you, that restriction. What's that one takeaway that you want teachers to think about when they're thinking about task design next week after the bank holiday? Don't expect them to work over the bank holiday weekend, but so one thing you want them to take away from this to think about, or it could be pointing them in the direction if they want to find out something else as well.
At Bloomsbury Education, we're passionate about supporting teachers with high-quality professional development books from leading experts. Whether you're navigating your first crucial years as an early career teacher, or a more experienced teacher looking to refresh your practice or take a step up into leadership, our award-winning books are here to help. We publish practical books to support teaching across primary and secondary, from the very best in research-led practice to trusted advice on inclusivity, behaviour and curriculum design. Visit the Bloomsbury Education website at bloomsbury.com/education to find out more and use code BLOOMTTR24 to save 20% on all education titles. Bloomsbury Education, books for every step of your teaching journey.
I've always considered myself to be a caring head teacher who acts sensitively to support staff mental health. But what I found increasingly difficult was managing the negative impact on staff mental health when resolving issues related to their employment or daily work. Heartfelt Leadership has been developed by TeachWell Toolkit as a handbook to support head teachers to overcome the challenges of school improvement while supporting staff well-being. We know that difficult conversations can quickly turn into conflict if procedures are not fully transparent, understood, and followed. Our handbook takes you through step-by-step processes while maintaining mutual respect, avoiding conflict, and finding solutions.
So, Elliot, what's that one takeaway that you want to give our audience after today's show?
So I'm going to do that annoying thing where you answer a question with a question. But this is, if you in my mind, if we were to boil down task design to one thing, and in my mind, this is the one thing that could have the most impact on task being more successful, and it is this question: what do I want the learner to think about? And that's the question that should guide any and all tasks, be that early years right up to sixth formers, any subject. Is the task getting the pupil to think about what you want them to think about?
Excellent. Lauren?
Wholehearted agree from me with Elliot. And then probably my question would be, what are the routines around task design in your classrooms that will ensure pupils focus on the content and not the process?
So, what do I want the learner to think about, and what are the routines around that task design within the classroom to make sure we focus on that learning? I think that's two really clear, tangible takeaways that will make the teachers and listeners to this think about what they're going to do and make changes to their own practice. Thank you very much for listening to Teachers Talk Radio tonight, and I hope you enjoyed this show all about task design and challenge with our guests Lauren Meadows, Elliot Morgan and Alex Bedford. Thank you both of you for joining us this evening.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's been great.
And it's been a fascinating conversation. I think it's one of those that we could go on for hours and hours, isn't it?
Absolutely.
So to listen back to Teachers Talk Radio, please download the Podbean app or visit your favourite podcast player and search Teachers Talk Radio. You can also visit tdradio.org/listenback. Follow us on Twitter at @TTRadioOfficial and tweet using the hashtag TTRadio. Thank you for listening, and until next time, goodbye.
You've been listening to Teachers Talk Radio. Tune in live and listen back at ttradio.org. We look forward to hearing from you next time on Teachers Talk Radio.